A few weeks ago, we were able to spend some time with the Kitchen Sisters, independent producers Davia Nelson and Nikki Silva. They create incredible sound-rich stories of hidden kitchens all over the world. And ever since their visit, I've been noticing the type of under-the-radar kitchens that they like to profile everywhere I go. So on today's show, I want to highlight some of the unexpected kitchens and unseen food rituals that we've discovered lately. From KCRW and KCRW.com, I'm Evan Kleiman, and you're listening to Good Food.
In prison, dinner was always a big thing. We had a pasta course, and then we had a meat or a fish. Paulie did the prep work. He was doing a year for contempt, and he had this wonderful system for doing the garlic. He used a razor, and he used to slice it so thin that it used to liquefy in the pan with just a little oil. It was a very good system. Vinny was in charge of the tomato sauce.
Wow, got the smell. That treat, the kinds of meat and meatballs.
What'd you put in it?
Veal, beef, and pork.
Good, but you gotta have the pork.
That's the flavor.
I felt he used too many onions, but it was still a very good sauce.
Vinny, don't put too many onions in the sauce.
I didn't put too much onions in there.
That scene from Goodfellas might be one of the most iconic food scenes of all time. Ray Liotta narrates the feast, Charles Scorsese cooking the sauce, Robert De Niro searing steaks, and Paul Sorvino delicately slicing a clove of garlic with a razor blade. After all, necessity is the mother of invention. That pithy quote of Plato's perfectly describes a prison population's response to being not only cut off from society, but on food sensory lockdown too. Daniel Jennis knows this well. He spent 10 years in New York State prisons and recently wrote a piece for the Daily Beast about learning to cook behind bars. So I have to ask you, do people actually cut garlic with a razor blade?
They actually do, and they do it in emulation of the film. And it's a very dangerous thing to do because razor blades are really, really illegal in prison. You'll get a year in the box for being caught with it. However, the appeal of the scene in the movie is so strong that the guys are willing to take the risk. And you can probably guess they all have vowels at the ends of their names. So that's who's cutting up the garlic that way.
Wow, that's just fascinating. Now, when you talk about cooking in prison, are you talking at all about joining the kitchen staff and making food for your fellow prisoners?
Certainly not. That is a job that is often given out to people, but the food that is served in prison comes basically pre-made in these awful bags. So working in a prison kitchen requires heating up the bags in boiling water and making some kind of carbohydrate to throw the slop on top.
So let's talk about that slop, just so we can put what people are cooking
Sure.
in their cells into context. Take me through a typical day of eating in prison.
Okay, first of all, the state has a trained nutritionist who has strict orders. There's a minimum of calories that has to be issued, as well as a minimum of vitamins, I suppose. And there is a budget. Everything's supposed to be done as cheaply as possible. During my 10 years, I was there from 2004 to 2014, I witnessed the deterioration of the food, especially after the crisis in 2007. Now, prisoners are supposed to be allotted protein, for example. Protein would suggest meat, fish, or chicken. However, in fact, what ends up being used is soy protein, which is a very unpleasant product that is basically made from the whey, W-H-E-Y, when you make tofu. What happens is they spread the stuff out on a tray to dry it, and then they fold it. Once it's dry, they fold it and fold it and fold it until it becomes a chunk. Now, that has protein in it, and therefore the state can use it. However, there's a slight problem. It also has about as much estrogen as you can put into something with protein. As a result, there's prisoners who have been eating this stuff for years and years and years, and some of them need a bra. However, prisoners do the best they can with what they get. And I can explain that when you're ready.
I'm kind of ready now. when I think about this idea of prisoners cooking in their cells, mm-hmm. I think about what you need to cook in that kind of situation. You need heat. Mm-hmm. You need an implement to cook stuff in, like a pot. And then you need ingredients.
Okay. Let's start with the ingredients, which can be sourced in three different ways. The first way the ingredients can be sourced is through theft. There's warehouses in prison where things come in that can be repurposed in order to make better food. And what I mean by that is onions, whiting that is served on a dietary basis, because some prisoners have special diets because they're older. That kind of stuff gets stolen and resold in the yard. The second way of sourcing food is through commissary. Commissary in prison is once every 2 weeks. You can spend a maximum of $55. Unfortunately, it's mostly canned food and snacks and sugary bad things. The two most luxurious things you can buy in commissary are Tyson fried chicken, which costs $6 and includes 6 pieces of fried chicken that guys refry. It's the celebratory food. And you can also buy Ben and Jerry's in a lot of places, $3. But prisoners are usually only paid about $3 every 2 weeks. So if you don't have your own money, this is basically off limits to you. The last way of sourcing food is through packages from home. This is a very painful procedure because the packages are analyzed and quite a few things are rejected. However, the packages to me were very important because it was the only way I had access to fresh things like vegetables. I received one cabbage every month for 10 years. But we should also discuss how the things are actually cooked.
Yeah, I would imagine that heat, a heat source in a cell, there must be some gray areas in terms of legality there.
First of all, you have to differentiate between maxes and mediums. In the medium where people live in a dormitory, 60-man dormitory, there's a small cooking area that usually involves a couple of microwaves. That is your heat source. In maxes, where I spent 7 years, you're cooking in a cell. There's two things that are legally available to you. One is called an immersion heater, which in prison slang is called a stinger. What it is a piece of curly metal that you drop into water, plug in, and it heats up and boils the water. What's interesting about it is that if you plug it in when there's no water surrounding it, it burns out. Because the way that the little thing is built is with sand inside. And if the sand does not feel the pressure of the water, the fuse blows. Luckily, there's a lot of craftsmen and guys who are handy with their hands in prison. So what they do is they manage to cut open the stinger or immersion heater and remove the sand, remove the fuse, and now it's direct. So using this kind of thing, you can heat up, you can actually make a bucket of water boil in about 45 minutes.
And yet I understand that boiling water is illegal in some prisons.
Well, the danger is actually not boiling water, but boiling oil. That is why the police don't actually want boiling things. So the other method of heating things, the stinger, the immersion heater, it costs $3. But if you're willing to spend $17, now you buy a hot pot. A hot pot is a clear thing that has a metallic bottom and a plastic top, and it holds perhaps 2 pints of liquid, and it heats for you. Now, the thing is that the pot has a regulator in the bottom of it that prevents boiling. So if you're trying to make, say, pasta, which is sold in the commissary, you're going to end up with sludge, which I had to learn the hard way. However, as everything else, you can alter the hot pot. You can replace the thermostat with a fake thermostat and wire it up direct. There's all kinds of ways to make it boil, and the cops know about this. So if they feel like it, they check to see whether your hot pot boils and then take it away from you. And then there goes your $17.
If you're just tuning in, I'm talking with Daniel Jenness. He recently wrote an article for the Daily Beast about learning to cook in prison. As he mentioned, the DIY culture in prison is a big deal. While a few inmates keep their mechanical knowledge secret in hopes of selling the contraptions, most are proud of their hacks, so knowledge spreads.
Let me tell you what can happen with the hot pot. Remember I said the hot pot had a metallic bottom, right? Everything else from the hot pot is removed. The plastic top is destroyed. The plastic bottom is destroyed. The fuses are destroyed. Everything but the coil and the metal is left. And the coil is the same coil you can imagine on a coffee machine. In fact, sometimes the cops' coffee machines get, the coils get stolen out of them for guys to build what I'm about to describe to you. It's called an eye. And what it is the coil that's mounted on top of a metal can and plugged in. Very easy to get shocked, very easy to get burned, but at the same time, now you have basically an electric stove. So now you need to find a metal basin of some sort. What I used to do is contract out with the guys in the warehouse to get the cans of tuna, because tuna comes into prison in 6-pound cans. They're very large. And I would have to get them smuggled to me, and I would have to pay for it. But once I had the can of tuna, I'd be able to fry or boil soup or, you know, basically cook. You know, I have to thank my family, who they were kind enough to bring me interesting things. I know that when the police had to go through the things and determine whether they were allowed in, they were often quite disgusted by the things that my family brought.
Like what?
Well, I should have mentioned in the beginning that ethnically I'm a Russian. At home, I speak Russian. I grew up with Russian food. So my family used to bring me tongues, smoked calf tongue. It costs about $7, and you can eat it right out of the package. But if you fry it a little bit, it tastes really good. Now, when the poor cops who had never seen such a thing had to handle a vacuum-packed calf's tongue, they were an absolute horror of this. Also, some of the vegetables that came in, they just had no idea what it was. And with the cans, they insisted on English lettering. We figured that out pretty quick, and we found that a lot of the cans sold in Brooklyn have English lettering added on. It was much harder for the Asians. I was in one prison where they had a community of 50, which is more than most, and they received a lot of cans of unusual things. For example, giant snails were brought in. And also, there was one fellow whose family owned a restaurant, so they had a vacuum packing device, and they could print labels. So they would just cook them huge amounts of Chinese food, pack it up in the vacuum, add the label, pretend it came from a store, and the cops would have to let it in.
So speaking about the Asian population, I understand that they managed to make dumplings. Could you describe how they made the dough?
Sure. Making dough in a prison where flour was forbidden was a very interesting process. Other prisons actually allow flour, which would have made it easier on these guys. But the one where I saw this happen did not allow flour. So it turns out that if you buy a bag of macaroni and soak it perhaps for 12, 16 hours in cold water, it'll turn into a gelatinous mass that you then roll out. You roll it with a can, and there is your dough right there. Afterwards, you chop up some raw cabbage and some onions and, of course, the meat, which unfortunately doesn't come raw, but you get as close as you can, and you make dumplings. The guy who sold them, he even included dumpling sauce, which was soy sauce and vinegar and some scallions. For one pack of cigarettes, I used to buy, I think it was 8 dumplings and the sauce.
So this gets into what to me is the biggest mystery. How did you guys keep, the cooking so hidden while the aromas would be wafting around? And how were you able to basically open these little stores and sell to one another?
Most of the cops don't care about the cooking. They really have other problems. Although I did once witness a guy's fried chicken get stomped out. But you were asking how these things get sold. Capitalism manages to find its way everywhere. And in prison, let's say the bills are the packs of cigarettes, while the change is stamps. What the guys would do is make up these little portions, hide them, let's say, in their pants, and go outside to the yard, and sell these things.
You know, so many people now are getting more interested in prison culture with the show Orange is the New Black. Have you been able to watch it at all?
My wife and I have watched it with pleasure.
And are any of the food scenes familiar to you?
They're a little exaggerated. I remember that the desserts are considered to be very highly valued. But in truth, the desserts that are given out by the state are really not very tasty and not very valuable.
Maybe that's the difference between a men's prison and a women's prison, though.
Well, I've actually met several women who've been in prison, and they said they all cooked and they baked and they made cookies, and they actually had access to much more equipment than us men did because they were more trusted not to be violent. I'll give you an example. My last prison was called a cooking facility, which meant there were actual stoves and actual pots and pans. But you know something? None of the pots or pans had handles. Because yes, but why were the handles removed? Because they're 10-inch pieces of metal that could theoretically be sharpened and used as a weapon. However, have you wondered how things get cut up in prison other than the illegal razors?
Yes.
Because even plastic knives are forbidden. However, every prison allows cans. So once the can is open, you have the lid. There is your knife right there. Now, if you take this thing to the yard and get caught with it, you're going to go to solitary for 1 year. However, if you're in your cell cutting up onions with the thing and the cop sees what you're doing, they understand.
What is a meal that you remember the most fondly as something that just hit a lot of the notes for you and gave you sort of that strength to just hang in?
In one of the prisons that I was in, there was a garden that was staffed by mentally ill people. It was considered therapy for them to grow things. But the truth is that the mentally ill people could care less about any of that stuff. And the men who were hired there as what's called a porter were the ones who ended up growing things. And what they did is they grew a whole bunch of basil. Now, everything that was grown in that little patch was supposed to go to the sick guys, but they really had no interest in the basil. So a friend of mine and me, what we did is we kind of bribed a guy to just steal it all. And when I say all, I mean several pounds of basil. The basil was brought back to us. We had olive oil that we had bought through a fundraiser. The Native Americans were selling olive oil. We did not have pinoli nuts, but we had Parmesan cheese, which is sold in commissary. So we made pesto, crushing up the basil with can tops and then mixing it to make the pesto is very, very difficult when you don't have the proper equipment. However, put on top of hot spaghetti after years of not having it, tastes just incredible.
And why don't you tell me the most disgusting thing that you ate while you were in prison?
Well, I could actually answer that by saying the food that the state provided, but it wouldn't be true because the most disgusting thing I ate in prison was made by a fellow prisoner. Now, as I mentioned before, anything that was alive or fresh was very highly valued. And one guy just took this to a whole nother level because what he learned to do was capture seagulls. I looked on the internet, by the way. I'm not the first to have ever eaten a seagull, but everyone does agree that it's about as repulsive as it gets. So this fellow learned how to capture the seagulls. He would pluck them and gut them right in his cell and carefully flush the toilet to make sure he wasn't plugging it up because that would have got him in trouble. And then he would treat them like squab and roast them, kind of, with you know, spices. He had intended to do this as a little business. He wanted to sell the seagulls. But no one, not one single person, was willing to eat it. Now, he ate the seagulls himself. I watched him do it. And after his business failed, he offered to just give me some. And I thought about it, and I said yes. And I took the seagull back to my cell. It was wrapped up in aluminum foil, I remember. And I looked at it, and I thought about how the seagull has been living on garbage and probably had worms and is probably not something I should eat. But then I thought to myself that one day I might be telling this story, so why don't I just have the courage to eat the nasty thing? The meat, by the way, it looks black, and it's greasy and very unappealing and stringy. And I ate it. I ate almost two-thirds of the seagull. I didn't want to deal with the thighs of it. It was mostly the breast, which would have been white meat on a chicken. It was utterly disgusting. I went back to the man and I said, you really shouldn't be doing this. No one will ever eat this, and I don't know why you're into it.
Did you get sick from it?
You know something? Not at all. I also saw a man eat a frog on a dare, and he survived that too.
Thank you so much.
Yes, no problem. I enjoyed this.
Daniel Jenness spent 10 years in New York State prisons. Check out our blog for a link to the piece he wrote about cooking in his cell for the Daily Beast. We've also got a link to the recent New Yorker profile on Daniel there, too. Coming up, the agony and ecstasy of lunch.
Make a donation of just a dollar a day, and you can join one of our exciting and exclusive Angel Clubs. Choose from music, books, DVDs, or cookbooks delivered right to your front door. Learn more and join now at kcrw.com/join.
Welcome back to Good Food. The tech industry is famous for providing free lunch to their employees. The Google campus up north has almost 30 restaurants and cafes where they serve their employees fresh food prepared on site for free. In LA, our industry is entertainment, and there's plenty of free food there too.
Oh, this is all so weird. It's making me sick to my stomach.
Lemonade. It's 8 o'clock in the morning. Are you eating those Mexican cheese curls?
Hey, don't knock my sabor de soledad. I found a prize in here the other day, I hope.
Liz Lemon's character in 30 Rock pretty much nails the constant snacking and ingesting in the writer's room. All those sitcom jokes require a lot of calories. I know this because I sent probably a million pounds of food to studio lots during my years at Angeli. These days, Monica Padrick is on the receiving end of that caloric avalanche. She wrote a vivid first-person account of what it's like to live in that river of food for the Lucky Peach all-you-can-eat issue. Hi.
Hi.
You know, it's one thing making that food and sending it off, but I don't think we ever really think about what it's like to be on the receiving end of all that food.
Oh, well, it's sort of a gluttonous deluge, and I know that you would like your food to be really enjoyed in this case, it's often just sort of a zombie-like shoveling. And so you feel bad that you often have such good food that you're eating so generally joylessly.
Joylessly. Tell me, how often do you get these deliveries? Is this something every day? Do they feed you to keep you captive there?
Well, I think we're keeping ourselves captive there. But I guess the way it works, and I haven't paid that close attention, but there's usually a period of time where you have to buy your own lunch, and it is utter hell. It is the worst time in your life. Then usually around when production starts, they start bringing lunch in, and we'll order from, there's probably 6 or 7 restaurants where we always get lunch. And around that time, we often start staying for dinner. And then there's a different sort of rotation of slightly nicer restaurants that we start ordering from. And then a little bit later, we start ordering second dinner, which is sometimes sugar-based, sometimes pizza-based.
So is the food literally on a giant conference table in the same room where you're working?
Well, the process is this. At around, 11 or so, or 11:30, our writer's assistant, Michael Waldron, a hero, the hero of this story, would pass around menus. We would say what we wanted, and then he would place the orders and pick it all up and bring it back to us. And this happened for lunch and for dinner. And there would just be one long table with all of the food that you ordered. And because Michael is the hero of this story, there'd be another table that had all the group food that he thought we wanted. So it would be group pizza, group fried chicken, group whatever, just communal food that he figured if you didn't order enough on your own, he was going to make sure you had enough food to make yourself very unhappy with yourself.
Is there like a famous freshman 15 amongst writers?
I think there is. And I think because I am pretty new to this profession and I'm still sort of in the wonderment phase of all of the free food, because it's not just food that we order. There's also the snacks that are there. You're looking at me like you're horrified. The snacks that are there constantly, which is, I think, the responsibility of an entirely different production assistant. And that's just a wall of your chips, your goldfish, your red vines, almonds, if you're going to be healthy, and then
your M&Ms.
Yes, there's definitely a communal 10-pound tub of peanut M&Ms that everyone just sticks their hands in.
This would be just a minefield for me to navigate. It would be a nightmare.
Yeah, well, there is, back to your original question, there is like a freshman 15 that you can see the more experienced writers, they're managing their meals a little bit better. They're not even looking at the menus. They're just choosing a salad that they can get chicken breast on. And while I'm like, do you see this place is famous for a short rib sandwich? I've got to eat that, right? One of the things that I write about in that article was the sort of desperate need to eat just because you get tired from sitting there and talking.
Yeah, you call this decision fatigue-related eating.
Yeah, I did not come up with this. This is the famous thing. But when trying to make sense of, or at least shift the blame for why I would just constantly eat so much, I asked a psychiatrist friend if she could just give me something to blame this on rather than my own inability to control myself. And she was like, this is a famous thing. You know, your brain gets tired of making decisions and it craves glucose. And then that kind of explains popping up and running out for a tub of ice cream that is always on hand.
What lot do you work on?
Oh, we're on Paramount.
Yes.
Which you have some familiarity with.
Oh, yeah. It's so funny because when you say that they passed out menus and each of you told the assistant in charge of the food ordering what you wanted to eat, I just remember what it was like to actually fulfill those orders in Los Angeles.
I'm sure. It's
where I'm not this, substitute that, and where you would have 30 sandwiches and not one sandwich would be like it was written on the menu.
No, we got very bold with our ordering. We would feel very entitled to getting it exactly how we wanted it. It wasn't us who had to do the embarrassing phone call. Little Waldron had to do that. He did offer to bring by 200 hot wings to this interview today. He's that dedicated.
I'm so grateful that he didn't. But hot wings in your article assumes another level of, it's almost like it's not even food.
Oh, no. It's like a joke in food form is what it came down to eventually. I mean, it was very exciting food at first. We had a ritual called Wings Friday, which started early in the season and which was decided on because wings are delicious and it seemed like a celebration and this was going to be fun. And then we did it every week. And every week when, you know, the wings would arrive at around 1 p.m. and they would be on this communal table until dinner came. So there would just be a graveyard of hot wings. I had a friend visit who worked on the lot for a different show, and she came in and was immediately knocked sideways by the sort of Hooters after the apocalypse, like, stink of the place, because it was just wings that had been left out for 4 hours, like tubs of blue cheese and ranch dressing. It's just, it's disgusting.
Did your mother cook for the family?
She did.
Have you related these food stories to your mother?
My parents are so impressed that I don't have to buy lunch that often. This is the biggest perk they have ever heard of in a job. And then I would occasionally take photos of my dinner orders and send them to my father just so he would be like, this is worth it. Keep doing this job. You're getting yourself a $40 steak on a Tuesday night and you're not paying for it. It was like I'd game the system somehow. So, no, they're thrilled. I mean, they're disgusted, but they're thrilled.
Thank you so much, Monica.
Thank you. This was fun.
Monica Padrick writes for Community. Formerly on NBC, the show was just picked up by Yahoo. Her article in Lucky Peach is Introduction to Decision Fatigue-Related Eating. Now, back to reality. For most of us, lunch at the office involves no PAs, no takeout, no midnight ice cream runs. It's just lunch, a nuisance that occurs midway through the workday. But Peter Miller, who owns an architectural and design bookstore in Seattle, has written a kind of manifesto on lunch in the workplace. It's called Lunch at the Shop, the Art and Practice of the Midday Meal. Hi, Peter.
Hi, top of the morning.
What was your aha moment about lunch? Did you have one?
The making lunch was because we just didn't have time, and we needed a lunch. And I said, well, I can make it. Let me just run down to the market, which was nearby, and get some things, and I'll make lunch, and then it will be solved. We were busy, and everyone going in four different directions wasn't going to help, and I realized, I can do this quite simply. The only aha was realizing that after we'd done it for that time, and then the next time, people realized, I think, that they were having a better lunch than their friends, or they were having a better lunch than they were going to buy, and they were saving the $10 or $12 or $15 that they were going to spend, and they were sitting with each other, which was, you know, a great relief and a great sort of entertainment. That was the aha.
But you're in a retail environment, so
right.
Do you actually put a sign on the door that says closed for lunch?
No, that's a courage that somewhere in my future perhaps I'll have. But the difficulty for us, of course, in this country is that lunchtime and the end of the day are the two busiest retail times. So I've just never had the courage to think, well, I can just shut the store because that's when people are coming. So typically what we do, one will go or two of us will go and make it, and then a couple of people will go and eat, and one person will simply watch the shop and then ferry back and join the group and eat together that way.
And what is the play back and forth between making and buying and bringing from home?
It's simple and it's complicated in that we never write up a schedule. Well, I guess if you have 100 people or you divide it into 20 people, you'd probably get into a schedule and say, who's in charge this week of picking up the bread? Since our numbers are small, we might talk about it at the end of today, what's tomorrow. If we're busy, it may not even come up, and we may have to jerry-rig or invent something or run out and get bread and butter to go with the meal or run out to get two lemons or two limes.
Do you have an inventory of pantry products that you always have because you know that you can just use a certain condiment in a lot of different ways?
Yeah, you have to. Some things you have to have just as a fact. You have to have a couple of mixing bowls, and you have to have some olive oil, and you have to have some vinegar. And it's wonderful if you can have a lemon and a lime. It's wonderful if you can have some butter, some feta cheese. These are more things that last a week or 2 weeks, and there's a certain amount of just upkeep and maintenance that you have to do. But if you're making the lunch every day, you find yourself keeping track of that, and you find yourself stopping at the market on the way home or the market coming in and saying, oh, let me get a head of lettuce. You know, people will text from the end of their dinner and say, we have plenty of chicken, I'm bringing it tomorrow.
So this, you know what this sounds like? This sounds like a family more than a group of coworkers.
It is a family, but without the weight of a family, because it's for this little theater of 10 minutes of prep and 24 minutes of eating, and then it's done. You know, I'll get a text that says, you know, we had extra soup, or someone brought over, you know, a big ham, and we can't eat all this. So it's coming in tomorrow. Figure out what we're going to do with it. The improvisation becomes possible if you have a few things on hand, if you have the mixing bowls and you have a lemon and you have some good salt and you have some good olive oil and you have some parsley or you have a avocado or something. And then you can fiddle and fool and you don't mind doing a little improvisation.
Yeah, well, there's so many quotable lines in the book, but one I really love is, lunch is not a full orchestra.
It's not a full orchestra, and it's not even that you're sure which instruments are going to show up. Worst case, an apple and some cheese, and I'd be fine. once you understand that just a few things will cover you, then the rest is kind of a luxury. It's a little bit like arts and crafts time when you're in kids in kindergarten or something. What we discovered that it's a great help if you have some cooked rice on hand, if you have some lentils on hand, or you have some pasta on hand. It's a great help if you have a avocado or a lemon. It's a huge help if you have some plain Greek yogurt, because you can mix things and you can line them up together. It's a great help if you have, you know, a little bit of chutney or marinated onions or olives, because kind of laid out on the table, you can make this little assembly of things, and that's lunch. You're done.
The lentil example, take me through how many different things you can do if you happen to have some cooked lentils on hand.
Oh, God, lentils are great because lentils love company. They're lonesome without it. So if you crumble some feta cheese and add a little olive oil to that and gently mix that in with some of the lentils, you've started. If you then add some salt and some fresh cracked pepper, you've made another step. If you then add some cilantro and sort of gently fold in a little avocado, you've gone further. If you then take a little bit of the completely plain Greek yogurt and you slightly blend that in, now you've really gone somewhere. And then if you had a little bit of basil, you're finished.
Thank you so much, Peter. It's like you've created this very beautiful wake-up call. And I just have to say, it's a beautiful book itself, The Object.
Pleasure. If you're this way, come on by. We'll make lunch.
Peter Miller's book is Lunch at the Shop, The Art and Practice of the Midday Meal. It also happens to be our latest cookbook club pick. Find out how you can join Good Food's cookbook club on our blog. Up next, a look at LA's very own Wild Foods Lab. And Jonathan Gold takes us to Roy Choi's pot at the Line Hotel. Stay with us.
Head over to the KCRW store to shop for vacations, wine classes, frequent flyer miles, dinners, and more. All in support of KCRW. They won't last long. Check it out now at kcrw.com/store.
I'm Evan Kleiman, and you're listening to Good Food. If you've seen the words forest floor, rabbit tobacco, or white fur on a menu lately, you probably have Pascal Baudard to thank. Along with Mia Wasilovich, the two run the Wild Food Lab, a sort of California alchemist den full of wild vinegar, insect sugar, and forage materials that are infused, dehydrated, and generally tinkered with in an effort to extract the true flavors of California. Pascal runs classes through the company Urban Outdoor Skills, and Mia helms Transitional Gastronomy, where she teaches classes and hosts private dinners based on forage foods. Hi, you two.
Hi.
Hello.
How are you?
Doing good.
So excited to be here.
Okay, so what was the origin of the lab? Have you been foraging for years and years and years?
It's something we did together. I didn't have a lab. We started, I started foraging like for 12 years. I started learning about the wild plant. And then I started teaching more like survival skills. But I became very interested by the food because a lot of the food that was made was not fantastic. It was mostly made by people who were survivalists and stuff like that. And for me, I say, oh my God, there's all these flavors. Nobody's doing anything with it. Then we met and Mia just, you know, inspired me. And we both inspired each other, took me to a brand new level, where I'm mostly doing the foraging part and then the preserving part, and Mia takes it to the chef level.
So Mia, did you already know survivalists when you met Pascal? Is that how you met?
Oh, no. No, I was pretty much a city girl, but I have traveled extensively, and in other countries, it's amazing. Normal, regular food that you get in cafes has a lot of foraged components. In other countries, they seem to use that as a food source. So I was familiar with it. But when I met Pascal, I was not into the survival thing at all. But we met, and it just was just so natural. He brought some stuff. We were in the kitchen. We're like, why don't we do this? Oh, that tastes really good. Oh, and then we became absolutely obsessed with it. And it's pretty much what we've been doing nonstop for almost 6 years, and we do it every day, every weekend. It's a passion.
You know, one of the things that really struck me when I was there was how it's sort of like this weird Venn diagram of survivalist pantry and incredible Epicurean palate. How do your survivalist-focused friends respond to the food?
They think we're a hoot. They get a kick out of it. And, you know, we help develop recipes with some of our friends.
Yeah,
you know?
True.
And sometimes if something's not palatable, they might ask us to, hey, can you figure out what the heck to do with this thing? And it's mutual admiration because I really admire what they do. And, you know, we've learned a lot from them, actually.
But a lot of our friends, I would not say are survivalists. They're more like foodies or people who are into foraging. It's different.
Yeah. Bunker.com.
Yeah, no.
Right. But our pantry is not preppers or anything.
We're actually really not preppers.
Not unless you really want to use a lot of elderberry flour vinegar.
Yeah, for example.
For example. Do you remember the two of you, or Pascal maybe, your first success at finding a forage material on a walk?
Mm-hmm.
And then turning it into something that was just shockingly delicious?
Yes, the black mustard flowers. I took some black mustard and I decided to mix it with vinegar, a little bit of white wine, and I made my first mustard and I gave it to somebody and he said, this is the best mustard I ever had. That was 7 years ago.
So this is wild mustard seed we're talking about.
Right. No, the flowers.
Flowers.
You can actually make mustard with the flowers, and then you can make mustard with the seeds.
You also find wild chia, which is tiny seeds.
Yeah.
Right. That's more of a, I don't know if we would go out and collect tons of wild chia. I mean, each chia flower has maybe 5 seeds in it, so maybe not. Maybe not.
Yeah, it's the last time we were there foraging, it was more than 100 degrees. You had 40 miles an hour wind, and you're shaking those little chia seeds. You know, so a lot of them are actually gone by the time you're already there. And we collected, one cup?
Right. But it's the foraging thing, it's more about the journey, you know, the journey of going out and connecting with your food. I know that sounds corny, but it's all of, you get excited. We're going to go on a trip. We're going to go explore something. Oh my gosh, it's so beautiful. And then the cherry on top of the sundae is really coming back and figuring out what to do with it.
In terms of one of the easiest delivery systems for the foraged materials, do you tend to rely a lot on infusions?
It varies. It's you have different seasons in California. The cool thing about California is we always have stuff. Now, during the winter, we get the greens. Then after the greens, we go into the flowers. And from the flowers, we go into the seeds. And then from the seeds, we also go into the fruits and berries and stuff. So we have different seasons. So the preserve is basically what nature tells us we have to preserve. Right now, it's mostly seeds time, which is why you get mustards.
Or lamb's quarter seeds or nettles that you can use, and they're related to amaranth and quinoa, so you can use them like that. But I don't think you can be or call yourself a forager if you don't know how to preserve, because the seasons are really, really short. And, you know, not to be survivally, but you have a 2-week season on something, maybe a 1-week season, or you have to collect fennel flowers now, especially with the extreme weather we have. So you really have to learn some form of preservation if you want to forage, I think.
Okay, Mia, I want you to take me through a dish, maybe the quinoa-like seeds that you use. And you made those beautiful little patties.
So right now, some parts of the lamb's quarters plant, it's called Belgian spinach. It's going into seed right now. So you use the leaves for a sauce. You can use the whole plant. So I use the leaves to make a velouté, like a nice sauce. And then, you know, me and a couple of my friends, we sat and pulled all the seeds, separated the seeds from the stalks, dehydrated the seeds. And then after they're ready, you still need to blanch them to take off some of the tannins, and it pulls off into a black water, and then you need to dehydrate them a little bit more, and then you cook them. So it's a long process, but it's one of my favorite ingredients. It's labor-intensive, but it's so amazing that you can, probably is really nutritious, has a lot of protein in it, but it's nature's quinoa to me.
It was almost like eating a really tender falafel.
Falafel. I've never thought of calling it a falafel, a wild falafel. It's exactly what it's like.
Thank you so much, both of you.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
That was Pascal Bodar and Mia Wasilovich. Together, they run the Wild Foods Lab. This summer, they have a lot of really cool classes, dinners, and foraging trips on the schedule. We've got a link to where you can find all of their upcoming events on our website, kcrw.com/goodfood. Time now for our weekly restaurant recommendation. Jonathan Gold's here to catch us up on where to eat this weekend in Los Angeles. He's the Pulitzer Prize-winning food writer at the LA Times, and this week he takes us to one of the most buzzed about restaurants to open this year. It's Roy Choi's Pot at the Line Hotel.
The restaurant is called Pot because I suppose the big hot pots are the center of dining here. And giant sort of stainless steel tureens that come out with stuff and then put it on the induction burner. They come in sizes that'll feed two people very comfortably to ones that'll serve as many people as you can possibly bring into the table.
Speak to me a little bit about Roy Choi doing Korean food in Koreatown.
Well, I think that saying you can go to other places and get things that are more authentic is wrong. I mean, this is Korean food designed by Koreans, you know, cooked by Koreans for a Korean crowd. I mean, he does things that tick Koreans off, and I think he owns it. I think he actually sort of loves it.
Like what?
Like he charges for some of the banchan. And charging for kimchi is something that's probably a hanging offense in Korea. You just don't charge for kimchi. They bring you a plate of like a couple things, you know, some garlic chives and some bean sprouts beforehand. But they also charge for, you know, the basic kimchi. They charge for this totally delightful banchan of pickled sea beans. And I'm fine with that, but it ticks people off. The dishes are almost all authentically Korean, except there's no Korean on the menu. And if you go in there and you want the budae-jjigae, which is the sort of transgressive dish anyway, the Korean stew with the hot dogs and the spam and the canned corned beef and the instant ramen and the Vienna sausages, then you're going to have to ask for a boot knocker. If you want the tofu dish, you don't ask for Soon Tofu. You ask for Jamal Wilkes. And if you're Roy Choi, you know the Jamal Wilkes nickname was Silk, and you're honoring the Lakers, and you're also eating something delicious. But if you're a hungry Korean guy who's going in and trying to figure out what to eat for dinner, it's not going to be super apparent what's what.
Okay, now that we've talked a little bit about the cultural experience, let's talk about the eating experience. What have you had here that you've absolutely loved?
The dishes I would say you absolutely have to have when you come here. The potato pancake, which is super broad. It's about the size of, let's say, an Earth, Wind, and Fire LP.
I love that.
And super crisp, and you cut off pieces of it, and you do it in a dipping sauce. There's something called Beep Beep, which is – actually, I don't get this solution, but it's okay. I don't have to get all of them. It's a dish of uni in dynamite sauce, the kind of dynamite sauce you get on, like, cheesy sushi, over a bowl of rice. And there's some crunchy things on it, and it's so good.
It sounds really good.
It shouldn't be good. It's like you're eating this, and you're saying, I shouldn't like this. I would reject this. But you're not rejecting. You're eating it, and the uni is good, and you're super happy about it. There's a salad they call kush, of course, with greens and radishes and sort of a nice oyster sauce dressing with chili in it. But I think the big in-joke of this is how really Korean this all is. In other words, it's taking Korean food and it's sort of making it American in presentation, but not in the way that it's cooked. From a subcultural point of view, it's fascinating. Because, for example, bibs, everybody wears bibs, which makes it faintly ridiculous and fun. are made out of super cheap, super bright prints of the sort that you can imagine getting at, you know, a Korean 99-cent store. And he may well have gotten them there, or he may have had them done couture. You don't know. The waiters and the waitresses are done up in extremely flattering cuts, but the fabric is the sort of fabric that you would associate with, you know, elderly Korean women. He's mixing stuff up like a DJ.
But it's kind of like a love song too.
Oh, it's totally a love song. I mean, it's totally his take on what it's like to grow up Korean in Los Angeles. I think it's a really important statement.
Thank you, Jonathan.
Glad to be here.
Jonathan Gold is the Pulitzer Prize-winning food writer for the LA Times. We've been talking about Roy Choi's Pot at the Line Hotel in Koreatown. Get a text with the restaurant's name, address, and Jonathan's recommended dishes by texting Good Food to 69866. Plus, find all of Jonathan's restaurant recommendations on Good Food's restaurant map. It's on the Good Food blog. The Market Report is next, so stay close.
Good Food is produced by KCRW, a listener-supported public radio station in Los Angeles, California. Support our programming by making a donation. Go to kcrw.com/join.
You're listening to Good Food on KCRW. It's that time when we check in with Laura Avery to find out what you should be shopping for at the Southern California Farmers Markets. She joins us now for a look at what's popping up this week in Southern California.
This is Laura Avery with the Market Report. We've caught up today with David LeFevre, who is chef owner of MB Post and Fishing with Dynamite down in Manhattan Beach. He's been coming to the market for years. David, you got your coffee in your hand and you're on a mission. What are you shopping for today? What's cooking at the restaurants?
You know, we're looking for a bunch of different stuff. I mean, obviously it's almost peak season here at the market, but three of the things that I'm eating today already have been some really killer honeylope melons from Munyak.
Is that the one that's orange flesh? Looks like a honeydew, but it's orange inside?
Yeah, it's orange flesh. They're small, super soft. It's almost like you're scooping sorbet out of them. And then there's some shishito peppers that are popping up at Erickson. Mm-hmm. And then tomatoes have hit. Like last week, obviously they were here. Tutti Frutti had some. But Coastal Organics, Mark at Coastal Organics, just has beautiful, beautiful little tiny cherry tomatoes that we're using at the restaurant and a bunch of different. We're using them at Fishing with Dynamite in one of our salads. We're using them at MB Post with one of our fish dishes. Actually, we're peeling the little cherry tomatoes and using them on a scallop dish that we're doing with a sweet dashi and smoked eggplant. But I mean, it's perfect out here right now. I mean, every booth that you walk to is beautiful and bright and flavorful, and all the chefs, you can just see they're all giddy about it.
They are. Now, how do you peel hundreds of little cherry tomatoes?
Well, there's a couple different ways you can do them, but basically it's a blanching, scoring and a blanching process, and then the skin just pops right off. Okay. But you got to do it for just like a millisecond because they're so tender already, and the flesh on a cherry tomato is so thin, they don't have a lot of structure and resistance. So when you do, it's just a light score and a quick blanch or a quick fry. Even sometimes people do it with oil. But you just get that skin off. It's one little step you can take to make them a little bit more palatable.
Mm-hmm. Sounds amazing. Yeah, Marianne Carpenter, their farm, Coastal, they you know that tomato season when the outdoor, not the hoop house, but the real outdoor tomatoes are here. We always kind of wait for that.
Yeah. Tomatoes and corn, when they come into season, I'm like, put it on a dish. Put it, like, we have like 7 or 8 dishes that have tomato and corn on it, which it goes against kind of like how I was trained. But when you have such a wonderful ingredient like that, it's like, how can you just put it on one dish? Especially corn.
What do you need to do? You steam it and peel it.
You know, Garrison Keillor said, sex is good, but nothing's better than fresh sweet corn.
That could be true. That's great. All right. Well, David, thank you so much. What an inspiration.
Thanks. Have a good day.
That was David LeFevre with a fabulous word of wisdom there about corn. He is the chef owner at MB Post and Fishing with Dynamite in Manhattan Beach. We're talking now with Mark Carpenter, who is the farmer at Coastal Farm that David was talking about. So you're knee-deep in boxes of tomatoes here in the back, and it's so beautiful. Tell us what you're growing, and tell us a little bit about how you plan and how you grow.
Well, we plan it out a year in advance. We get our planting schedule, and buy all the seeds and turn all the seeds into the nursery. And so that's all kind of set in motion a year in advance. This year, we're growing a ton of different varieties of cherry tomatoes, three or four different kinds of just red tomatoes, fresh eating red, and of course our sauce tomato, and then a whole array of heirloom tomatoes.
So people will come to you and they'll say, I want a slicer, or I want a sauce tomato, or I want this, or I want that. And can you kind of help people pick the right tomato?
Yeah, generally, I mean, we're growing like, for instance, a beefsteak tomato that's kind of like an acidic tomato. And a lot of the chefs really only put it on like a hamburger. As far as like the early girl, which is a super juicy, sweet, fresh eating tomato, sometimes they roast those in the oven and roast them down, or they, you know, use them in like a caprese salad or something. But if they buy a beefsteak and they're not used to the acidic taste, they're like, oh, these aren't very good. But they have their certain purpose, and they're great on a hamburger.
People don't realize, I think, about how many different flavors tomatoes have, and then the colors, sizes, shapes. And I love the cherry tomatoes because, like, in one flat, there's like 12 different baskets of cherry tomatoes.
That's true. Yeah, we're really, really proud of our cherry tomatoes, and we try to do the whole color of the rainbow. The green ones are special to us, and we love all the different colors.
Yeah, it's in full season now, and you're going to have plenty of tomatoes till Thanksgiving, right?
We hope so. Yeah, definitely hope so, till at least October.
All right, Mark. Well, this is beautiful, and you're kind of the real sign that tomato season has officially arrived.
Well, thank you.
That was Mark Carpenter. He's the owner, farmer at Coastal Farm. He and his wife, Pernilla, his mom and dad, they've been coming to the market farming here since you were a little tiny kid. For the Market Report, this is Laura Avery.
You can also find my very favorite sauce tomatoes at Mark Carpenter's stand. Just ask him for Evan's sauce tomato, and then check out my recipe on the Good Food blog. If you missed any part of today's show, you can listen anytime you want at kcrw.com or via iTunes. You can also find Good Food on Demand on KCRW's smartphone apps. And follow us on Twitter. I'm at Evan Kleiman, and you can follow Good Food at KCRW Good Food. Thanks to everybody who made today's show possible. Jillian, Laryl, Sarah, Caroline, Ronnie, and Gary. I'm Evan Kleiman. Join me back here next week for another edition of Good Food.